Those guys won't have the nerve or the money to start a test case. But he stopped. James Taggart leaned back in his chair, watching them. He was beginning to enjoy the conversation.
"Yes," said Dr. Ferris, "I'm thinking of it, too. I'm thinking of a certain tycoon who is in a position to blast us to pieces. Whether we'll recover the pieces or not is hard to tell. God knows what is liable to happen at a hysterical time like the present, and in a situation as delicate as this. Anything can throw everything off balance. Blow up the whole works. And if there's anyone who wants to do it, he does. He does, and can. He knows the real issue. He knows the things which must not be said, and he is not afraid to say them. He knows the one dangerous, fatally dangerous weapon. He is our deadliest adversary."
"Who?" asked Lawson. Dr. Ferris hesitated, shrugged, and answered,
"The guiltless man."
Lawson stared blankly.
"What do you mean, and whom are you talking about?"
James Taggart smiled.
"I mean that there is no way to disarm any man," said Dr. Ferris, "except through guilt, through that which he himself has accepted as guilt. If a man has ever stolen a dime, you can impose on him the punishment intended for a bank robber, and he will take it. He'll bear any form of misery. He'll feel that he deserves no better. If there's not enough guilt in the world, we must create it. If we teach a man that it's evil to look at spring flowers, and he believes us and then does it, we'll be able to do whatever we please with him. He won't defend himself. He won't feel he's worth it. He won't fight. But save us from the man who lives up to his own standards. Save us from the man of clean conscience. He's the man who'll beat us."
"Are you talking about Henry Reardon?" asked Taggart, his voice peculiarly clear. The one name they had not wanted to pronounce struck them into an instant's silence.
"What if I were?" asked Dr. Ferris cautiously.
"Oh, nothing," said Taggart. "Only if you were, I would tell you that I can deliver Henry Reardon. He'll sign." By the rules of their unspoken language, they all knew, from the tone of his voice, that he was not bluffing.
"God, Jim! No!" gasped Wesley Mouch.
"Yes," said Taggart. "I was stunned, too, when I learned what I learned. I didn't expect that. Anything but that."
"I am glad to hear it," said Mouch cautiously. "It's a constructive piece of information. It might be very valuable indeed."
"Valuable, yes," said Taggart pleasantly.
"When do you plan to put the directive into effect?"
"Oh, we have to move fast. We don't want any news of it to leak out. I expect you all to keep this most strictly confidential. I'd say that we'll be ready to spring it on them in a couple of weeks.
Don't you think that it would be advisable, before all prices are frozen, to adjust the matter of the railroad rates?
I was thinking of a raise, a small but most essentially needed raise."
"We'll discuss it, you and I," said Mouch amiably. "It might be arranged."
He turned to the others. Boyle's face was sagging. "There are many details still to be worked out, but I'm sure that our program won't encounter any major difficulties." He was assuming the tone and manner of a public address. He sounded brisk and almost cheerful. "Rough spots are to be expected. If one thing doesn't work, we'll try another. Trial and error is the only pragmatic rule of action. We'll just keep on trying. If any hardships come up, remember that it's only temporary. Only for the duration of the national emergency."
"Say," asked Kinnan, "how is the emergency to end if everything is to stand still?"
"Don't be theoretical," said Mouch impatiently. "We've got to deal with a situation of the moment. Don't bother about minor details so long as the broad outlines of our policy are clear.
we'll have the power. We'll be able to solve any problem and answer any question.
Fred Kinnan chuckled. Who is Jung Galt?
Don't say that, cried Taggart.
I have a question to ask about point 7, said Kinnan. It says that all wages, prices, salaries, dividends, profits, and so forth will be frozen on the date of the directive.
Taxes, too?
Oh, no, cried Mouch. How can we tell what funds we'll need in the future?
Kinnan seemed to be smiling.
Well, snapped Mouch, what about it?
Nothing, said Kinnan. I just asked.
Mouch leaned back in his chair.
I must say to all of you that I appreciate your coming here and giving us the benefit of your opinions.
It has been very helpful. He leaned forward to look at his desk calendar and sat over it for a moment, toying with his pencil. Then the pencil came down, struck a date, and drew a circle around it.
Directive 10-289 will go into effect on the morning of May 1st. All nodded approval. None looked at his neighbor. James Taggart rose, walked to the window, and pulled the blind down over the white obelisk. In the first moment of awakening, Dagny was astonished to find herself looking at the spires of unfamiliar buildings against a glowing, pale blue sky. Then she saw the twisted seam of the thin stocking on her own leg. She felt a wrench of discomfort in the muscles of her waistline, and she realized that she was lying on the couch in her office, with the clock on her desk saying 6:15, and the first rays of the sun giving silver edges to the silhouettes of the skyscrapers beyond the window. The last thing she remembered was that she had dropped down on the couch, intending to rest for 10 minutes, when the window was black and the clock stood at 3:30. She twisted herself to her feet, feeling an enormous exhaustion. The lighted lamp on the desk looked futile in the glow of the morning, over the piles of paper which were her cheerless, unfinished task. She tried not to think of the work for a few minutes longer, while she dragged herself past the desk to her washroom and let handfuls of cold water run over her face. The exhaustion was gone by the time she stepped back into the office. No matter what night preceded it, she had never known a morning when she did not feel the rise of a quiet excitement that became a tightening energy in her body and a hunger for action in her mind. Because this was the beginning of day, and it was a day of her life. She looked down at the city. The streets were still empty. It made them look wider, and in the luminous cleanliness of the spring air they seemed to be waiting for the promise of all the greatness that would take form in the activity about to pour through them. The calendar in the distance said May 1st. She sat down at her desk, smiling in defiance at the distastefulness of her job. She hated the reports that she had to finish reading, but it was her job. It was her railroad. It was morning. She lighted a cigarette, thinking that she would finish this task before breakfast. She turned off the lamp and pulled the papers forward. There were reports from the general managers of the 4 regions of the Taggart system, their pages a typewritten cry of despair over the breakdowns of equipment. There was a report about a wreck on the main line near Winston, Colorado. There was the new budget of the operating department, the revised budget based on the raise in rates which Jim had obtained last week. She tried to choke the exasperation of hopelessness as she went slowly over the budget's figures. All those calculations had been made on the assumption that the volume of freight would remain unchanged and that the raise would bring them added revenue by the end of the year. She knew that the freight tonnage would go on shrinking, that the raise would make little difference, that by the end of this year their losses would be greater than ever. When she looked up from the pages, she saw with a small jolt of astonishment that the clock said 9:25. She had been dimly aware of the usual sound of movement and voices in the anteroom of her office, as her staff had arrived to begin their day. She wondered why nobody had entered her office and why her telephone had remained silent. As a daily rule, there should have been a rush of business by this hour. She glanced at her calendar. There was a note that the McNeil Car Foundry of Chicago was to phone her at 9 a.m. in regard to the new freight cars which Taggart Transcontinental had been expecting for 6 months.
She flicked the switch of the interoffice communicator to call her secretary. The girl's voice answered with a startled little gasp.
"Miss Taggart, are you here? In your office?"
"I slept here last night again. Didn't intend to, but did. Was there a call for me from the McNeil Car Foundry?"
"No, Miss Taggart."
"Put them through to me immediately when they call."
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
Switching the communicator off, she wondered whether she imagined it or whether there had been something strange in the girl's voice. It had sounded unnaturally tense. She felt the faint light-headedness of hunger and thought that she should go down to get a cup of coffee, but there was still the report of the chief engineer to finish, so she lighted one more cigarette. The chief engineer was out on the road, supervising the reconstruction of the main track with the Reardon metal rail taken from the corpse of the John Galt line. She had chosen the sections most urgently in need of repair. Opening his report, she read, with a shock of incredulous anger, that he had stopped work in the mountain section of Winston, Colorado. He recommended a change of plans. He suggested that the rail intended for Winston be used instead to repair the track of their Washington to Miami branch. He gave his reasons. A derailment had occurred on that branch last week, and Mr. Tinky Holloway of Washington, traveling with a party of friends, had been delayed for 3 hours. It had been reported to the chief engineer that Mr. Holloway had expressed extreme displeasure. "Although from a purely technological viewpoint," said the chief engineer's report, "the rail of the Miami branch was in better condition than that of the Winston section, one had to remember, from a sociological viewpoint, that the Miami branch carried a much more important class of passenger traffic. Therefore, the chief engineer suggested that Winston could be kept waiting a little longer, and recommended the sacrifice of an obscure section of mountain trackage for the sake of a branch where Taggart Transcontinental could not afford to create an unfavorable impression." She read, slashing furious pencil marks on the margins of the pages, thinking that her first duty of the day, ahead of any other, was to stop this particular piece of insanity. The telephone rang. "Yes," she asked, snatching the receiver. "McNeil Car Foundry?" "No," said the voice of her secretary. "Senor Francisco D'Anconia." She looked at the phone's mouthpiece for the instant of a brief shock. "All right. Put him on." The next voice she heard was Francisco's. "I see that you're in your office just the same," he said. His voice was mocking, harsh, and tense. "Where did you expect me to be? How do you like the new suspension?"
"What suspension?"
"The moratorium on brains."
"What are you talking about?"
"Haven't you seen today's newspapers?"
"No."
There was a pause. Then his voice came slowly, changed and grave.
"Better take a look at them, Dagny." "All right."
"I'll call you later." She hung up and pressed the switch of the communicator on her desk.
"Get me a newspaper," she said to her secretary.
"Yes, Miss Taggart," the secretary's voice answered grimly. It was Eddie Willers who came in and put the newspaper down on her desk. The meaning of the look on his face was the same as the tone she had caught in Francisco's voice, the advance notice of some inconceivable disaster. "None of us wanted to be first to tell you," he said very quietly, and walked out. When she rose from her desk a few moments later, she felt that she had full control of her body and that she was not aware of her body's existence. She felt lifted to her feet, and it seemed to her that she stood straight, not touching the ground. There was an abnormal clarity about every object in the room, yet she was seeing nothing around her, but she knew that she would be able to see the thread of a cobweb if her purpose required it, just as she would be able to walk with a somnambulist's assurance along the edge of a roof. She could not know that she was looking at the room with the eyes of a person who had lost the capacity and the concept of doubt, and what remained to her was the simplicity of a single perception and of a single goal. She did not know that the thing which seemed so violent, yet felt like such a still, unfamiliar calm within her, was the power of full certainty. and that the anger shaking her body, the anger which made her ready, with the same passionate indifference either to kill or to die, was her love of rectitude, the only love to which all the years of her life had been given. Holding the newspaper in her hand, she walked out of her office and on toward the hall. She knew, crossing the anteroom, that the faces of her staff were turned to her, but they seemed to be many years away. She walked down the hall, moving swiftly but without effort, with the same sensation of knowing that her feet were probably touching the ground, but that she did not feel it. She did not know how many rooms she crossed to reach Jim's office, or whether there had been any people in her way. She knew the direction to take and the door to pull open to enter unannounced and walk toward his desk. The newspaper was twisted into a roll by the time she stood before him. She threw it at his face. It struck his cheek and fell down to the carpet. "There's my resignation, Jim," she said. "I won't work as a slave or as a slave driver." She did not hear the sound of his gasp. It came with the sound of the door closing after her. She went back to her office and, crossing the anteroom, signaled Eddie to follow her inside. She said, her voice calm and clear, "I have resigned." He nodded silently. "I don't know as yet what I'll do in the future. I'm going away to think it over and to decide. If you want to follow me, I'll be at the lodge in Woodstock." It was an old hunting cabin in a forest of the Berkshire Mountains, which she had inherited from her father and had not visited for years. "I want to follow," he whispered. "I want to quit, and I can't. I can't make myself do it." "Then will you do me a favor?" "Of course." "Don't communicate with me about the railroad. I don't want to hear it. Don't tell anyone where I am, except Hank Reardon. If he asks, tell him about the cabin and how to get there. But no one else. I don't want to see anybody."
"All right."
"Promise?"
"Of course.
When I decide what's to become of me, I'll let you know."
"I'll wait."
"That's all, Eddie."
He knew that every word was measured and that nothing else could be said between them at this moment. He inclined his head, letting it say the rest, then walked out of the office. She saw the chief engineer's report still lying open on her desk and thought that she had to order him at once to resume the work on the Winston section, then remembered that it was not her problem any longer. She felt no pain. She knew that the pain would come later and that it would be a tearing agony of pain, and that the numbness of this moment was a rest granted to her, not after, but before, to make her ready to bear it. But it did not matter. "If that is required of me, then I'll bear it," she thought. She sat down at her desk and telephoned Reardon at his mills in Pennsylvania.
"Hello, dearest," he said.
He said it simply and clearly, as if he wanted to say it because it was real and right, and he needed to hold on to the concepts of reality and rightness.
"Hank, I've quit."
"I see." He sounded as if he had expected it.
"Nobody came to get me. No destroyer. Perhaps there never was any destroyer after all. I don't know what I'll do next, but I have to get away, so that I won't have to see any of them for a while. Then I'll decide. I know that you can't go with me right now."
"No. I have 2 weeks in which they expect me to sign their gift certificate. I want to be right here when the 2 weeks expire."
"Do you need me for the 2 weeks?"
"No. It's worse for you than for me. You have no way to fight them. I have. I think I'm glad they did it. It's clear and final. Don't worry about me. Rest. Rest from all of it first."
"Yes."
"Where are you going?"
"To the country. To a cabin I own in the Berkshires. If you want to see me, Eddie Willers will tell you the way to get there. I'll be back in 2 weeks."
"Will you do me a favor?"
"Yes. Don't come back until I come for you.
But I want to be here when it happens.
Leave that up to me.
Whatever they do to you, I want it done to me also.
Leave it up to me. Dearest, don't you understand? I think that what I want most right now is what you want. Not to see any of them. But I have to stay here for a while. So it will help me if I know that you at least are out of their reach. I want to keep one clean point in my mind to lean against. It will be only a short while, and then I'll come for you. Do you understand?
Yes, my darling. So long.
It was weightlessly easy to walk out of her office and down the stretching halls of Taggart Transcontinental. She walked, looking ahead, her steps advancing with the unbroken, unhurried rhythm of finality. Her face was held level, and it had a look of astonishment, of acceptance, of repose. She walked across the concourse of the terminal. She saw the statue of Nathaniel Taggart, but she felt no pain from it and no reproach, only the rising fullness of her love, only the feeling that she was going to join him, not in death, but in that which had been his life. The first man to quit at Reardon Steel was Tom Colby, rolling mill foreman, head of the Reardon Steelworkers Union. For 10 years he had heard himself denounced throughout the country because his was a company union and because he had never engaged in a violent conflict with the management. This was true. No conflict had ever been necessary. Reardon paid a higher wage scale than any union scale in the country, for which he demanded and got the best labor force to be found anywhere. When Tom Colby told him that he was quitting, Reardon nodded, without comment or questions.
I won't work under these conditions myself, Colby added quietly, and I won't help to keep the men working. They trust me. I won't be the Judas goat leading them to the stockyards.
What are you going to do for a living? Asked Reardon.
I've saved enough to last me for about a year.
And after that?
Colby shrugged. Reardon thought of the boy with the angry eyes who mined coal at night as a criminal. He thought of all the dark roads, the alleys, the backyards of the country where the best of the country's men would now exchange their services in jungle barter, in chance jobs, in unrecorded transactions. He thought of the end of that road. Tom Colby seemed to know what he was thinking.
"You're on your way to end up right alongside of me, Mr. Reardon," he said. "Are you going to sign your brains over to them?"
"No."
"And after that?"
Reardon shrugged. Colby's eyes watched him for a moment, pale, shrewd eyes in a furnace-tanned face with soot-engraved wrinkles.
"They've been telling us for years that it's you against me, Mr. Reardon. But it isn't. It's Orrin Boyle and Fred Kinnan against you and me."
"I know it."
The wet nurse had never entered Reardon's office, as if sensing that that was a place he had no right to enter. He always waited to catch a glimpse of Reardon outside. The directive had attached him to his job as the mill's official watchdog of over or under production. He stopped Reardon a few days later in an alley between the rows of open hearth furnaces. There was an odd look of fierceness on the boy's face.
"Mr. Reardon," he said, "I wanted to tell you that if you want to pour 10 times the quota of Reardon metal or steel or pig iron or anything and bootleg it all over the place to anybody at any price, I wanted to tell you to go ahead. I'll fix it up. I'll juggle the books. I'll fake the reports. I'll get phony witnesses. I'll forge affidavits. I'll commit perjury. So you don't have to worry. There won't be any trouble."
"Now why do you want to do that?" asked Reardon, smiling, but his smile vanished when he heard the boy answer earnestly.
"Because I want, for once, to do something moral."
"That's not the way to be moral,"
Reardon started, and stopped abruptly, realizing that it was the way. The only way left,
realizing through how many twists of intellectual corruption upon corruption this boy had to struggle toward his momentous discovery.
"I guess that's not the word," the boy said sheepishly. "I know it's a stuffy, old-fashioned word. That's not what I meant. I meant..."
It was a sudden, desperate cry of incredulous anger.
"Mr. Reardon, they have no right to do it."
"What?"
"Take Reardon Medal away from you."
Reardon smiled and, prompted by a desperate pity, said,
"Forget it, non-absolute. There are no rights."
"I know there aren't. But I mean... what I mean is that they can't do it."
"Why not?"
He could not help smiling.
"Mr. Reardon, don't sign the gift certificate. Don't sign it on principle."
"I won't sign it. But there aren't any principles."
"I know there aren't."
He was reciting it in full earnestness, with the honesty of a conscientious student.
"I know that everything is relative, and that nobody can know anything, and that reason is an illusion, and that there isn't any reality. But I'm just talking about Reardon Medal. Don't sign, Mr. Reardon. Morals are no morals. Principles are no principles. Just don't sign it. Because it isn't right."
No one else mentioned the directive in Reardon's presence. Silence was the new aspect about the mills. The men did not speak to him when he appeared in the workshops, and he noticed that they did not speak to one another. The personnel office received no formal resignations. But every other morning, one or two men failed to appear and never appeared again. Inquiries at their homes found the homes abandoned and the men gone. The personnel office did not report these desertions, as the directive required. Instead, Reardon began to see unfamiliar faces among the workers, the drawn, beaten faces of the long unemployed, and heard them addressed by the names of the men who had quit. He asked no questions. There was silence throughout the country. He did not know how many industrialists had retired and vanished on May 1st and 2nd, leaving their plants to be seized. He counted 10 among his own customers, including McNeil of the McNeil Car Foundry in Chicago. He had no way of learning about the others. No reports appeared in the newspapers. The front pages of the newspapers were suddenly full of stories about spring floods, traffic accidents, school picnics, and golden wedding anniversaries. There was silence in his own home. Lillian had departed on a vacation trip to Florida in mid-April. It had astonished him as an inexplicable whim. It was the first trip she had taken alone since their marriage. Philip avoided him with a look of panic. His mother stared at Reardon in reproachful bewilderment. She said nothing, but she kept bursting into tears in his presence, her manner suggesting that her tears were the most important aspect to consider in whatever disaster it was that she sensed approaching. On the morning of May 15th, he sat at the desk in his office, above the spread of the mills, and watched the colors of the smoke rising to the clear blue sky. There were spurts of transparent smoke, like waves of heat, invisible but for the structures that shivered behind them. There were streaks of red smoke and sluggish columns of yellow and light floating spirals of blue. And the thick, tight, swiftly pouring coils that looked like twisted bolts of satin tinged a mother-of-pearl pink by the summer sun. The buzzer rang on his desk, and Miss Ives' voice said, "Dr. Floyd Ferris to see you, without appointment, Mr. Reardon." In spite of its rigid formality, her tone conveyed the question, "Shall I throw him out?" There was a faint movement of astonishment in Reardon's face, barely above the line of indifference. He had not expected that particular emissary. He answered evenly, "Ask him to come in." Dr. Ferris did not smile as he walked toward Reardon's desk. He merely wore a look suggesting that Reardon knew full well that he had good reason to smile, and so he would abstain from the obvious. He sat down in front of the desk, not waiting for an invitation. He carried a briefcase, which he placed across his knees. He acted as if words were superfluous, since his reappearance in this office had made everything clear. Reardon sat watching him in patient silence. "Since the deadline for the signing of the National Gift Certificates expires tonight at midnight," said Dr. Ferris, in the tone of a salesman extending a special courtesy to a customer, "I have come to obtain your signature, Mr. Reardon." He paused, with an air of suggesting that the formula now called for an answer.
"Go on," said Reardon. "I am listening."
"Yes, I suppose I should explain," said Dr. Ferris, "that we wish to get your signature early in the day in order to announce the fact on a national news broadcast. Although the gift program has gone through quite smoothly, there are still a few stubborn individualists left who have failed to sign. Small fry, really, whose patents are of no crucial value, but we cannot let them remain unbound as a matter of principle, you understand. They are, we believe, waiting to follow your lead. You have a great popular following, Mr. Reardon, much greater than you suspected or knew how to use. Therefore, the announcement that you have signed will remove the last hopes of resistance and, by midnight, will bring in the last signatures, thus completing the program on schedule." Reardon knew that of all possible speeches, this was the last Dr. Ferris would make if any doubt of his surrender remained in the man's mind.
"Go on," said Reardon evenly. "You haven't finished."
"You know, as you have demonstrated at your trial, how important it is and why that we obtain all that property with the voluntary consent of the victims." Dr. Ferris opened his briefcase. "Here is the gift certificate, Mr. Reardon. We have filled it out, and all you have to do is to sign your name at the bottom." The piece of paper, which he placed in front of Reardon, looked like a small college diploma, with the text printed in old-fashioned script and the particulars inserted by typewriter. The thing stated that he, Henry Reardon, hereby transferred to the nation all rights to the metal alloy now known as Reardon Metal, which would henceforth be manufactured by all who so desired, and which would bear the name of Miracle Metal, chosen by the representatives of the people. Glancing at the paper, Reardon wondered whether it was a deliberate mockery of decency, or so low an estimate of their victims' intelligence that had made the designers of this paper print the text across a faint drawing of the Statue of Liberty. His eyes moved slowly to Dr. Ferris's face.
"You would not have come here," he said, "unless you had some extraordinary kind of blackjack to use on me. What is it?"
"Of course," said Dr. Ferris. "I would expect you to understand that. That is why no lengthy explanations are necessary." He opened his briefcase. "Do you wish to see my blackjack? I have brought a few samples." In the manner of a card sharp whisking out a long fan of cards with one snap of the hand, he spread before Reardon a line of glossy photographic prints. There were photostats of hotel and auto court registers, bearing in Reardon's handwriting the names of Mr. and Mrs. J. Smith.
"You know, of course," said Dr. Ferris softly, "but you might wish to see whether we know it, that Mrs. J. Smith is Miss Dagny Taggart."
He found nothing to observe in Reardon's face. Reardon had not moved to bend over the prints, but sat looking down at them with grave attentiveness, as if, from the perspective of distance, he were discovering something about them which he had not known. "We have a great deal of additional evidence," said Dr. Ferris, and tossed down on the desk a photostat of the jeweler's bill for the ruby pendant.
"You wouldn't care to see the sworn statements of apartment house doormen and night clerks. They contain nothing that would be new to you, except the number of witnesses who know where you spent your nights in New York for about the last 2 years. You mustn't blame those people too much. It's an interesting characteristic of epochs such as ours that people begin to be afraid of saying the things they want to say, and afraid, when questioned, to remain silent about things they'd prefer never to utter. That is to be expected. But you would be astonished if you knew who gave us the original tip."
I know it, said Reardon. His voice conveyed no reaction. The trip to Florida was not inexplicable to him any longer.
There is nothing in this blackjack of mine that can harm you personally, said Dr. Ferris. We knew that no form of personal injury would ever make you give in. Therefore, I am telling you frankly that this will not hurt you at all. It will only hurt Miss Taggart.
Reardon was looking straight at him now, but Dr. Ferris wondered why it seemed to him that the calm, closed face was moving away into a greater and greater distance.
If this affair of yours is spread from one end of the country to the other, said Dr. Ferris, by such experts in the art of smearing as Bertram Scudder, it will do no actual damage to your reputation. Beyond a few glances of curiosity and a few raised eyebrows in a few of the stuffier drawing rooms, you will get off quite easily. Affairs of this sort are expected of a man. In fact, it will enhance your reputation. It will give you an aura of romantic glamour among the women, and among the men, it will give you a certain kind of prestige, in the nature of envy for an unusual conquest. But what it will do to Miss Taggart, with her spotless name, her reputation for being above scandal, her peculiar position of a woman in a strictly masculine business, what it will do to her, what she will see in the eyes of everyone she meets, what she will hear from every man she deals with, I will leave that up to your own mind to imagine and to consider. Reardon felt nothing but a great stillness and a great clarity. It was as if some voice were telling him sternly, "This is the time. The scene is lighted. Now look." And standing naked in the great light, he was looking quietly, solemnly, stripped of fear, of pain, of hope, with nothing left to him but the desire to know. Dr. Ferris was astonished to hear him say slowly, in the dispassionate tone of an abstract statement that did not seem to be addressed to his listener, "But all your calculations rest on the fact that Miss Taggart is a virtuous woman, not the slut you're going to call her."
"Yes, of course," said Dr. Ferris.
"And that this means much more to me than a casual affair."
"Of course.
If she and I were the kind of scum you're going to make us appear, your blackjack wouldn't work."
"No, it wouldn't."
"If our relationship were the depravity you're going to proclaim it to be, you'd have no way to harm us."
"No."
"We'd be outside your power."
"Actually, yes."
It was not to Dr. Ferris that Reardon was speaking. He was seeing a long line of men stretched through the centuries from Plato onward, whose heir and final product was an incompetent little professor with the appearance of a gigolo and the soul of a thug.
"I offered you once a chance to join us," said Dr. Ferris. "You refused. Now you can see the consequences.
How a man of your intelligence thought he could win by playing it straight, I can't imagine." "But if I had joined you," said Reardon with the same detachment, as if he were not speaking about himself, "what would I have found worth looting from Oren Boyle?"
"Oh, hell, there's always enough suckers to expropriate in the world."
"Such as Miss Taggart, as Ken Daniger, as Ellis Wyatt, as I."
"Such as any man who wants to be impractical."
"You mean that it is not practical to live on Earth, is it?"
He did not know whether Dr. Ferris answered him. He was not listening any longer. He was seeing the pendulous face of Oren Boyle with the small slits of pig's eyes, the doughy face of Mr. Moen with the eyes that scurried away from any speaker and any fact. He was seeing them go through the jerky motions of an ape, performing a routine it had learned to copy by muscular habit, performing it in order to manufacture Reardon metal, with no knowledge and no capacity to know what had taken place in the experimental laboratory of Reardon Steel through 10 years of passionate devotion to an excruciating effort. It was proper that they should now call it Miracle Medal. A miracle was the only name they could give to those 10 years and to that faculty from which Reardon Medal was born. A miracle was all that the medal could be in their eyes, the product of an unknown, unknowable cause, an object in nature not to be explained, but to be seized, like a stone or a weed, theirs for the seizing. Are we to let the many remain in want while the few withhold from us the better products and methods available? If I had not known that my life depends on my mind and my effort, he was saying soundlessly to the line of men stretched through the centuries, if I had not made it my highest moral purpose to exercise the best of my effort and the fullest capacity of my mind in order to support and expand my life, you would have found nothing to loot from me, nothing to support your own existence. It is not my sins that you are using to injure me, but my virtues. My virtues, by your own acknowledgment, since your own life depends on them, since you need them, since you do not seek to destroy my achievement, but to seize it. He remembered the voice of the gigolo of science saying to him, "We're after power, and we mean it. You fellows were pikers, but we know the real trick." "We were not after power," he said to the gigolo's ancestors in spirit, "and we did not live by means of that which we condemned. We regarded productive ability as virtue, and we let the degree of his virtue be the measure of a man's reward. We drew no advantage from the things we regarded as evil. We did not require the existence of bank robbers in order to operate our banks, or of burglars in order to provide for our homes, or of murderers in order to protect our lives. But you need the products of a man's ability. Yet you proclaim that productive ability is a selfish evil, and you turn the degree of a man's productiveness into the measure of his loss. We lived by that which we held to be good, and punished that which we held to be evil. You live by that which you denounce as evil, and punish that which you know to be good." He remembered the formula of the punishment that Lillian had sought to impose on him, the formula he had considered too monstrous to believe, and he saw it now in its full application as a system of thought, as a way of life, and on a world scale. There it was, the punishment that required the victim's own virtue as the fuel to make it work. His invention of Reardon Medal being used as the cause of his expropriation, Dagny's honor and the depth of their feeling for each other being used as a tool of blackmail, a blackmail from which the depraved would be immune. And in the people's states of Europe, millions of men being held in bondage by means of their desire to live, by means of their energy drained in forced labor, by means of their ability to feed their masters, by means of the hostage system, of their love for their children or wives or friends, by means of love, ability, and pleasure as the fodder for threats and the bait for extortion, with love tied to fear, ability to punishment, ambition to confiscation, with blackmail as law, with escape from pain, not quest for pleasure, as the only incentive to effort and the only reward of achievement. Men held enslaved by means of whatever living power they possessed and of whatever joy they found in life. Such was the code that the world had accepted, and such was the key to the code, that it hooked man's love of existence to a circuit of torture, so that only the man who had nothing to offer would have nothing to fear, so that the virtues which made life possible and the values which gave it meaning became the agents of its destruction, so that one's best became the tool of one's agony, and man's life on earth became impractical. "Yours was the code of life," said the voice of a man whom he could not forget. "What, then, is theirs?" Why had the world accepted it, he thought. How had the victims come to sanction a code that pronounced them guilty of the fact of existing? And then the violence of an inner blow became the total stillness of his body as he sat looking at a sudden vision. Hadn't he done it also? Hadn't he given his sanction to the code of self-damnation? Dagny, he thought, and the depth of their feeling for each other, the blackmail from which the depraved would be immune. Hadn't he, too, once called it depravity? Hadn't he been first to throw at her all the insults which the human scum was now threatening to throw at her in public? Hadn't he accepted as guilt the highest happiness he had ever found? You who won't allow 1% of impurity into an alloy of metal, the unforgotten voice was saying to him, what have you allowed into your moral code? Well, Mr. Reardon, said the voice of Dr. Ferris, do you understand me now? Do we get the medal, or do we make a public showplace out of Miss Taggart's bedroom? He was not seeing Dr. Ferris. He was seeing, in the violent clarity that was like a spotlight tearing every riddle open to him, the day he met Dagny for the first time. It was a few months after she had become vice president of Taggart Transcontinental. He had been hearing skeptically for some time the rumors that the railroad was run by Jim Taggart's sister. That summer, when he grew exasperated at Taggart's delays and contradictions over an order of rail for a new cutoff, an order which Taggart kept placing, altering, and withdrawing, somebody told him that if he wished to get any sense or action out of Taggart Transcontinental, he'd better speak to Jim's sister. He telephoned her office to make an appointment and insisted on having it that same afternoon. Her secretary told him that Miss Taggart would be at the construction site of the new cutoff that afternoon, at Milford Station between New York and Philadelphia, but would be glad to see him there if he wished. He went to the appointment resentfully. He did not like such business women as he had met, and he felt that railroads were no business for a woman to play with. He expected a spoiled heiress who used her name and sex as substitute for ability, some eyebrow-plucked, over-groomed female, like the lady executives of department stores. He got off the last car of a long train, far beyond the platform of Milford Station. There was a clutter of sidings, freight cars, cranes, and steam shovels around him, descending from the main track down the slope of a ravine where men were grading the roadbed of the new cutoff. He started walking between the sidings toward the station building. Then he stopped. He saw a girl standing on top of a pile of machinery on a flat car. She was looking off at the ravine, her head lifted, strands of disordered hair stirring in the wind. Her plain gray suit was like a thin coating of metal over a slender body against the spread of sun-flooded space and sky. Her posture had the lightness and unself-conscious precision of an arrogantly pure self-confidence. She was watching the work, her glance intent and purposeful, the glance of competence enjoying its own function. She looked as if this were her place, her moment, and her world. She looked as if enjoyment were her natural state. Her face was the living form of an active, living intelligence, a young girl's face with a woman's mouth. She seemed unaware of her body except as of a taut instrument ready to serve her purpose in any manner she wished. Had he asked himself a moment earlier whether he carried in his mind an image of what he wanted a woman to look like, he would have answered that he did not. Yet seeing her, he knew that this was the image, and that it had been for years. But he was not looking at her as at a woman. He had forgotten where he was and on what errand. He was held by a child's sensation of joy in the immediate moment, by the delight of the unexpected and undiscovered. He was held by the astonishment of realizing how seldom he came upon a sight he truly liked. Liked in complete acceptance and for its own sake. He was looking up at her with a faint smile, as he would have looked at a statue or a landscape, and what he felt was the sheer pleasure of the sight, the purest aesthetic pleasure he had ever experienced. He saw a switchman going by, and he asked, pointing, "Who is that?"
"Dagny Taggart," said the man, walking on.
Reardon felt as if the words struck him inside his throat. He felt the start of a current that cut his breath for a moment, then went slowly down his body, carrying in its wake a sense of weight, a drained heaviness that left him no capacity but one. He was aware, with an abnormal clarity, of the place, the woman's name, and everything it implied, but all of it had receded into some outer ring and had become a pressure that left him alone in the center, as the ring's meaning and essence. And his only reality was the desire to have this woman, now, here, on top of the flat car in the open sun, to have her before a word was spoken between them, as the first act of their meeting, because it would say everything, and because they had earned it long ago. She turned her head. In the slow curve of the movement, her eyes came to his and stopped. He felt certain that she saw the nature of his glance, that she was held by it, yet did not name it to herself. Her eyes moved on, and he saw her speak to some man who stood beside the flat car, taking notes. Two things struck him together: his return to his normal reality, and the shattering impact of guilt. He felt a moment's approach to that which no man may feel fully and survive. A sense of self-hatred, the more terrible because some part of him refused to accept it and made him feel guiltier. It was not a progression of words, but the instantaneous verdict of an emotion, a verdict that told him this, then, was his nature, this was his depravity, that the shameful desire he had never been able to conquer came to him in response to the only sight of beauty he had found, that it came with a violence he had not known to be possible, and that the only freedom now left to him was to hide it and to despise himself, but never to be rid of it so long as he and this woman were alive. He did not know how long he stood there, or what devastation that span of time left within him. All that he could preserve was the will to decide that she must never know it. He waited until she had descended to the ground and the man with the notes had departed. Then he approached her and said coldly, "Miss Taggart, I am Henry Reardon." "Oh." It was just a small break. Then he heard the quietly natural, "How do you do, Mr. Reardon?" He knew, not admitting it to himself, that the break came from some faint equivalent of his own feeling. She was glad that a face she had liked belonged to a man she could admire. When he proceeded to speak to her about business, his manner was more harshly abrupt than it had ever been with any of his masculine customers. Now, looking from the memory of the girl on the flat car to the gift certificate lying on his desk, he felt as if the two met in a single shock, fusing all the days and doubts he had lived between them, and, by the glare of the explosion, in a moment's vision of a final sum, he saw the answer to all his questions. He thought, "Guilty? Guiltier than I had known. Far guiltier than I had thought that day. Guilty of the evil of damning as guilt that which was my best. I damned the fact that my mind and body were a unit, and that my body responded to the values of my mind. I damned the fact that joy is the core of existence, the motive power of every living being, that it is the need of one's body as it is the goal of one's spirit, that my body was not a weight of inanimate muscles, but an instrument able to give me an experience of superlative joy to unite my flesh and my spirit. That capacity, which I damned as shameful, had left me indifferent to sluts, but gave me my one desire in answer to a woman's greatness. That desire, which I damned as obscene, did not come from the sight of her body, but from the knowledge that the lovely form I saw did express the spirit I was seeing. It was not her body that I wanted, but her person. It was not the girl in gray that I had to possess, but the woman who ran a railroad. But I damned my body's capacity to express what I felt.
I damned, as an affront to her, the highest tribute I could give her. Just as they damn my ability to translate the work of my mind into Reardon metal. Just as they damn me for the power to transform matter to serve my needs. I accepted their code and believed, as they taught me, that the values of one's spirit must remain as an impotent longing, unexpressed in action, untranslated into reality, while the life of one's body must be lived in misery, as a senseless, degrading performance, and those who attempt to enjoy it must be branded as inferior animals. I broke their code, but I fell into the trap they intended. The trap of a code devised to be broken. I took no pride in my rebellion. I took it as guilt. I did not damn them, I damned myself. I did not damn their code, I damned existence. And I hid my happiness as a shameful secret. I should have lived it openly, as of our right, or made her my wife, as in truth she was. But I branded my happiness as evil and made her bear it as a disgrace. What they want to do to her now, I did it first. I made it possible. I did it, in the name of pity for the most contemptible woman I know. That, too, was their code, and I accepted it. I believed that one person owes a duty to another with no payment for it in return. I believed that it was my duty to love a woman who gave me nothing, who betrayed everything I lived for, who demanded her happiness at the price of mine. I believed that love is some static gift which, once granted, need no longer be deserved. Just as they believe that wealth is a static possession which can be seized and held without further effort. I believed that love is a gratuity, not a reward to be earned, just as they believe it is their right to demand an unearned wealth. And just as they believe that their need is a claim on my energy, so I believed that her unhappiness was a claim on my life. For the sake of pity, not justice, I endured 10 years of self-torture. I placed pity above my own conscience, and this is the core of my guilt. My crime was committed when I said to her, by every standard of mine, to maintain our marriage will be a vicious fraud. But my standards are not yours. I do not understand yours, I never have, but I will accept them. Here they are, lying on my desk, those standards I accepted without understanding. Here is the manner of her love for me, that love which I never believed but tried to spare. Here is the final product of the unearned. I thought that it was proper to commit injustice so long as I would be the only one to suffer. But nothing can justify injustice. And this is the punishment for accepting as proper that hideous evil which is self-immolation. I thought that I would be the only victim. Instead, I've sacrificed the noblest woman to the vilest. When one acts on pity against justice, it is the good whom one punishes for the sake of the evil. When one saves the guilty from suffering, it is the innocent whom one forces to suffer. There is no escape from justice. Nothing can be unearned and unpaid for in the universe, neither in matter nor in spirit. And if the guilty do not pay, then the innocent have to pay it. It was not the cheap little looters of wealth who have beaten me. It was I. They did not disarm me. I threw away my weapon. This is a battle that cannot be fought except with clean hands, because the enemy's sole power is in the sores of one's conscience, and I accepted a code that made me regard the strength of my hands as a sin and a stain.
Do we get the medal, Mr. Reardon?
He looked from the gift certificate on his desk to the memory of the girl on the flat car,
He asked himself whether he could deliver the radiant being he had seen in that moment to the looters of the mind and the thugs of the press. Could he continue to let the innocent bear punishment? Could he let her take the stand he should have taken? Could he now defy the enemy's code when the disgrace would be hers, not his? When the muck would be thrown at her, not at him? When she would have to fight, while he'd be spared? Could he let her existence be turned into a hell he would have no way of sharing? He sat still, looking up at her. "I love you," he said to the girl on the flat car, silently pronouncing the words that had been the meaning of that moment 4 years ago, feeling the solemn happiness that belonged with the words, even though this was how he had to say it to her for the first time. He looked down at the gift certificate. "Dagny," he thought, "you would not let me do it if you knew. You will hate me for it if you learn. But I cannot let you pay my debts. The fault was mine, and I will not shift to you the punishment which is mine to take. Even if I have nothing else now left to me, I have this much, that I see the truth, that I am free of their guilt, that I can now stand guiltless in my own eyes, that I know I am right, right fully and for the first time, and that I will remain faithful to the one commandment of my code which I have never broken, to be a man who pays his own way. I love you," he said to the girl on the flat car, feeling as if the light of that summer's sun were touching his forehead, as if he too were standing under an open sky over an unobstructed earth, with nothing left to him except himself. "Well, Mr. Reardon, are you going to sign?" asked Dr. Ferris. Reardon's eyes moved to him. He had forgotten that Ferris was there. He did not know whether Ferris had been speaking, arguing, or waiting in silence. "Of that," said Reardon. He picked up a pen, and with no second glance, with the easy gesture of a millionaire signing a check, he signed his name at the foot of the Statue of Liberty and pushed the gift certificate across the desk. Chapter 7. The Moratorium on Brains.
"Where have you been all this time?" Eddie Willers asked the worker in the underground cafeteria, and added, with a smile that was an appeal, an apology, and a confession of despair, "Oh, I know it's I who have stayed away from here for weeks."
The smile looked like the effort of a crippled child groping for a gesture that he could not perform any longer.
"I did come here once, about 2 weeks ago. But you weren't here that night. I was afraid you'd gone. So many people are vanishing without notice. I hear there's hundreds of them roving around the country. The police have been arresting them for leaving their jobs. They're called deserters. But there's too many of them, and no food to feed them in jail. So nobody gives a damn anymore, one way or another. I hear the deserters are just wandering about, doing odd jobs, or worse. Who's got any odd jobs to offer these days? It's our best men that we're losing, the kind who've been with the company for 20 years or more. Why did they have to chain them to their jobs? Those men never intended to quit. But now they're quitting at the slightest disagreement, just dropping their tools and walking off, any hour of the day or night, leaving us in all sorts of jams. The men who used to leap out of bed and come running if the railroad needed them. You should see the kind of human driftwood we're getting to fill the vacancies. Some of them mean well, but they're scared of their own shadows. Others are the kind of scum I didn't think existed. They get the jobs, and they know that we can't throw them out once they're in, so they make it clear that they don't intend to work for their pay and never did intend. They're the kind of men who like it, who like the way things are now. Can you imagine that there are human beings who like it? Well, there are. You know, I don't think that I really believe it, all that's happening to us these days. It's happening, all right. But I don't believe it.
I keep thinking that insanity is a state where a person can't tell what's real. Well, what's real now is insane. And if I accepted it as real, I'd have to lose my mind, wouldn't I? I go on working, and I keep telling myself that this is Taggart Transcontinental. I keep waiting for her to come back, for the door to open at any moment, and... Oh, God, I'm not supposed to say that. What? You knew it? You knew that she's gone? They're keeping it secret. But I guess everybody knows it. Only nobody is supposed to say it. They're telling people that she's away on a leave of absence. She's still listed as our vice president in charge of operation. I think Jim and I are the only ones who know that she has resigned for good. Jim is scared to death that his friends in Washington will take it out on him if it becomes known that she's quit. It's supposed to be disastrous for public morale if any prominent person quits, and Jim doesn't want them to know that he's got a deserter right in his own family. But that's not all. Jim is scared that the stockholders, the employees, and whoever we do business with will lose the last of their confidence in Taggart Transcontinental if they learn that she's gone. Confidence. You'd think that it wouldn't matter now, since there's nothing any of them can do about it. And yet, Jim knows that we have to preserve some semblance of the greatness that Taggart Transcontinental once stood for. And he knows that the last of it went with her. Now they don't know where she is. Yes, I do, but I won't tell them. I'm the only one who knows. Oh, yes, they've been trying to find out. They've tried to pump me in every way they could think of, but it's no use. I won't tell anyone. You should see the trained seal that we now have in her place, our new operating vice president. Oh, sure, we have one. That is, we have and we haven't. It's like everything they do today. It is and it ain't at the same time. His name is Clifton Losey. He's from Jim's personal staff. A bright, progressive young man of 47 and a friend of Jim's. He's only supposed to be pinch-hitting for her, but he sits in her office, and we all know that that's the new operating vice president. He gives the orders. That is, he sees to it that he's never caught actually giving an order. He works very hard at making sure that no decision can ever be pinned down on him so that he won't be blamed for anything. You see, his purpose is not to operate a railroad, but to hold a job. He doesn't want to run trains. He wants to please Jim. He doesn't give a damn whether there's a single train moving or not, so long as he can make a good impression on Jim and on the boys in Washington. So far, Mr. Clifton Losey has managed to frame up two men. A young third assistant for not relaying an order which Mr. Losey had never given, and the freight manager for issuing an order which Mr. Losey did give, only the freight manager couldn't prove it. Both men were fired officially by ruling of the Unification Board. When things go well, which is never longer than half an hour, Mr. Losey makes it a point to remind us that these are not the days of Miss Taggart. At the first sign of trouble, he calls me into his office and asks me, casually, in the midst of the most irrelevant drivel, what Miss Taggart used to do in such an emergency. I tell him, whenever I can. I tell myself that it's Taggart Transcontinental, and there's thousands of lives on dozens of trains that hang on our decisions. Between emergencies, Mr. Losey goes out of his way to be rude to me. That's so I wouldn't think that he needs me. He's made it a point to change everything she used to do, in every respect that doesn't matter, but he's damn cautious not to change anything that matters. The only trouble is that he can't always tell which is which. On his first day in her office, he told me that it wasn't a good idea to have a picture of Nat Taggart on the wall. Nat Taggart, he said, belongs to a dark past, to the age of selfish greed. He is not exactly a symbol of our modern progressive policies, so it could make a bad impression. People could identify me with him. No, they couldn't, I said. But I took the picture off his wall. What? No. She doesn't know any of it.
I haven't communicated with her. Not once. She told me not to. Last week, I almost quit. It was over Chick's special. Mr. Chick Morrison of Washington, whoever the hell he is gone on a speaking tour of the whole country to speak about the directive and build up the people's morale, as things are getting to be pretty wild everywhere. He demanded a special train for himself and party, a sleeper, a parlor car, and a diner with bar room and lounge. The Unification Board gave him permission to travel at 100 miles an hour, by reason, the ruling said, of this being a non-profit journey. Well, so it is. It's just a journey to talk people into continuing to break their backs at making profits in order to support men who were superior by reason of not making any. Well, our trouble came when Mr. Chick Morrison demanded a diesel engine for his train. We had none to give him. Every diesel we own is out on the road, pulling the Comet and the Transcontinental Freights, and there wasn't a spare one anywhere on the system except... Well, that was an exception I wasn't going to mention to Mr. Clifton Losey. Mr. Losey raised the roof, screaming that come hell or high water, we couldn't refuse a demand of Mr. Chick Morrison. I don't know what damn fool finally told him about the extra diesel that was kept at Winston, Colorado, at the mouth of the tunnel. You know the way our diesels break down nowadays. They're all breathing their last, so you can understand why that extra diesel had to be kept at the tunnel. I explained it to Mr. Losey. I threatened him. I pleaded. I told him that she had made it our strictest rule that Winston Station was never to be left without an extra diesel. He told me to remember that he was not Miss Taggart, as if I could ever forget it, and that the rule was nonsense, because nothing had happened all these years, so Winston could do without a diesel for a couple of months, and he wasn't going to worry about some theoretical disaster in the future when we were up against the very real, practical, immediate disaster of getting Mr. Chick Morrison angry at us. Well, Chick's special got the diesel. The superintendent of the Colorado division quit. Mr. Losey gave that job to a friend of his own. I wanted to quit. I had never wanted to so badly. But I didn't. No, I haven't heard from her. I haven't heard a word since she left. Why do you keep questioning me about her? Forget it. She won't be back. I don't know what it is that I'm hoping for. Nothing, I guess. I just go day by day, and I try not to look ahead. At first, I hoped that somebody would save us. I thought maybe it would be Hank Reardon. But he gave in. I don't know what they did to him to make him sign, but I know that it must have been something terrible. Everybody thinks so. Everybody's whispering about it, wondering what sort of pressure was used on him. No. Nobody knows. He's made no public statements, and he's refused to see anyone. But listen, I'll tell you something else that everybody's whispering about. Lean closer, will you? I don't want to speak too loudly. They say that Orrin Boyle seems to have known about that directive long ago, weeks or months in advance, because he had started, quietly and secretly, to reconstruct his furnaces for the production of Reardon metal, in one of his lesser steel plants, an obscure little place way out on the coast of Maine. He was ready to start pouring the metal the moment Reardon's gift certificate was signed. But listen, the night before they were to start, Boyle's men were heating the furnaces in that place on the coast when they heard a voice. They didn't know whether it came from a plane or a radio or some sort of loudspeaker, but it was a man's voice, and it said that he would give them 10 minutes to get out of the place. They got out. They started going, and they kept on going, because the man's voice had said that he was Ragnar Danneskjold. In the next half hour, Boyle's mills were razed to the ground. Razed. Wiped out. Not a brick of them left standing. They say it was done by long-range naval guns from somewhere way out on the Atlantic. Nobody saw Daniskild's ship. That's what people are whispering. The newspapers haven't printed a word about it. The boys in Washington say that it's only a rumor spread by panic mongers. I don't know whether the story is true. I think it is. I hope it is. You know, when I was 15 years old, I used to wonder how any man could become a criminal. I couldn't understand what would make it possible. Now I'm glad that Ragnar Daniskild has blown up those mills. May God bless him and never let them find him, whatever and wherever he is. Yes, that's what I've come to feel. Well, how much do they think people can take? It's not so bad for me in the daytime because I can keep busy and not think, but it gets me at night. I can't sleep anymore. I lie awake for hours. Yes, if you want to know it. Yes, it's because I'm worried about her. I'm scared to death for her. Woodstock is just a miserable little hole of a place, miles away from everything, and the Taggart Lodge is 20 miles farther, 20 miles of a twisting trail in a godforsaken forest. How do I know what might happen to her there, alone, and with the kind of gangs that are roving all through the country these nights? Just through such desolate parts of the country as the Berkshires. I know I shouldn't think about it. I know that she can take care of herself. Only I wish she'd drop me a line. I wish I could go there. But she told me not to. I told her I'd wait. You know, I'm glad you're here tonight. It helps me. Talking to you and just seeing you here. You won't vanish, like all the others, will you? What? Next week? Oh, on your vacation. For how long? How do you rate a whole month's vacation? I wish I could do that, too. Take a month off at my own expense. But they wouldn't let me. Really? I envy you. I wouldn't have envied you a few years ago. But now? Now I'd like to get away. Now, I envy you. If you've been able to take a month off every summer for 12 years. It was a dark road, but it led in a new direction. Reardon walked from his mills, not toward his house, but toward the city of Philadelphia. It was a great distance to walk, but he had wanted to do it tonight, as he had done it every evening of the past week. He felt at peace in the empty darkness of the countryside, with nothing but the black shapes of trees around him, with no motion but that of his own body and of branches stirring in the wind, with no lights but the slow sparks of the fireflies flickering through the hedges. The 2 hours between mills and city were his span of rest. He had moved out of his home to an apartment in Philadelphia. He had given no explanation to his mother and Philip. He had said nothing except that they could remain in the house if they wished, and that Miss Ives would take care of their bills. He had asked them to tell Lillian when she returned that she was not to attempt to see him. They had stared at him in terrified silence. He had handed to his attorney a signed blank check and said, "Get me a divorce. On any grounds and at any cost. I don't care what means you use, how many of their judges you purchase, or whether you find it necessary to stage a frame-up of my wife. Do whatever you wish. But there is to be no alimony and no property settlement." The attorney had looked at him with the hint of a wise, sad smile, as if this were an event he had expected to happen long ago. He had answered, "Okay, Hank. It can be done, but it will take some time. Make it as fast as you can." No one had questioned him about his signature on the gift certificate, but he had noticed that the men at the mills looked at him with a kind of searching curiosity, almost as if they expected to find the scars of some physical torture on his body. He felt nothing, nothing but the sense of an even, restful twilight,
like a spread of slag over a molten metal when it crusts and swallows the last brilliant spurt of the white glow within. He felt nothing at the thought of the looters who were now going to manufacture Reardon metal. His desire to hold his right to it and proudly to be the only one to sell it had been his form of respect for his fellow men, his belief that to trade with them was an act of honor. The belief, the respect, and the desire were gone. He did not care what men made, what they sold, where they bought his metal, or whether any of them would know that it had been his. The human shapes moving past him in the streets of the city were physical objects.